tonight as we continue our study in apologetics. What I want to do tonight is look at four simple steps that kind of bring together the ideas that we've been talking about to try and just boil it down to just something very simple that is easy to remember and therefore that we can quickly use, get it out of our holster quickly and be able to use it in a practical and effective way in standing against the assaults that come our way. And I believe if you're able to remember these four things while you're in discussion and debating with somebody about this when you're trying to defend the faith, I believe you'll be able to stand against any kind of intellectual assault that will come your way. You would be able to at least weather the storm. You'd be able to stand unmoved. You might not be able to adequately deal with the sophistication of the argument just because you might be unfamiliar with the stuff, with the facts and the details. But I believe you can still apply these principles even in that context and you will be able to stand. You don't have to have a PhD in order to defend the faith even against very sophisticated people. If you can get a grasp on these four steps, these four principles, keep them working in your mind, I believe you will stand firmly. We have touched on them in our studies that we've done thus far, but I thought it would be good to just get in a distilled, concise way so that you can actually walk away with something in your hand and say, okay, I know what to do. Should this attack come, I know exactly how to go about defending my faith. And you'll be able to, I believe you'd not only be able to stand, but I believe you'd be able to dismantle practically any argument that came your way. I really believe it's possible if you grasp these things. So this is really a summary of what we've been dealing with thus far. I just want to try and put it in a nutshell for you, the main principles. Now, no matter what statement the unbeliever makes, what is the question you're going to ask him? How do you know? How do you know? That's where you want to start. That's where you're going to start every time. How do you know that that's so? Whatever. You know, you don't always need to put it in those exact words, but that's what you're aiming at. That's the goal. That's the objective you're trying to attain. And you just keep asking that question to his subsequent explanation. So as he explains and he fills something out, then you ask him, don't just be like a parrot, how do you know? How do you know? How do you know? You know, that kind of ruins any kind of interaction. So, you know, be wise, be sensitive, be engaging and stuff. But that's the question you want to ask. Mix it up and vary it up a bit. But start there. What you're trying to find out by asking this question, you're not trying to be clever. What you're trying to find out is, what is the goal when you ask it? Basically, you're trying to identify his final authority. What is he resting upon? What gives him his foundation? So where is his final authority? That's what you're trying to get to. Now, he might throw up a lot of red herrings to mislead you, but you keep drilling down until he gets to a point where he identifies what his final authority actually is. So the unbeliever says, to believe in the existence of the Christian God is the height of ignorance and superstition. You'll get that. There's the kind of an aggressive approach that some people will take. And your response? How do you know that? Why do you say that? How can you be sure that that is true? And how might he answer? Everybody knows. Everybody knows. He might come on the attack and say, well, have you ever seen God? Have you ever seen God? Now, you can respond in a gracious way. No, I've never seen God. But once again, what are you after? How do you know? So you could reword it, you could put it in, you want to ask him how he knows that seeing or not seeing with the physical eye is the final test for what exists and is possible. How do you know that? How do you come to that conclusion? So you're asking the same question, and how do you know that in order to prove something's legitimacy or existence, I've got to see it with my physical eye? So when he asks if you've seen God, you say no, but please explain how my not seeing God proves that he doesn't exist. How does that support your case and prove your case? How do you know that that is legitimate proof of the existence of God? He's now explaining, because often what happens, the unbeliever is just shooting challenges to you and getting you running all over the place trying to answer his misdirected things. So you put him on the defensive in a sense and get him to speak and explain the context of his worldview. So you're trying to find out what his final authority is. Always keep this in mind, since getting him to identify his final authority is vital to unraveling his worldview. That's what you're going to use to help dismantle his whole structure, which he is so confident in. He's absolutely sure of his position, and he stands there, and he now is firing upon you with great glee and enthusiasm. Ultimately, I will say it's going to be practically every case, but there may be an exception. That person's final authority is going to be himself. That's what it's going to be. Now, he might cover that up in different ways. He might shroud it around. But as you keep pressing and pushing, that is where you're going to come to. He is his ultimate authority, and that's where his confidence is, that's where his authority resides. So he might point to different things that serve as his ultimate authority. He might point to science, he might point to tradition, he might point to the majority, he might point to logic, these kinds of things. That's what I'm looking at. Or while science has established this point, or the majority say it, but ultimately when you push him further, you'll see that it comes back to him. Because even when he claims one of these things is his ultimate authority, science for example, he is still being a law unto himself. This is because there's no universal agreement among scientists. So he's going to be choosing which scientists to follow, which opinions to agree with, which ones to reject. There's no universal agreement what the majority believes. You're always going to be picking and choosing. You're going to be adopting your majority report that you like and rejecting the majority report that you don't like. So the whole time, the unbeliever is the final authority. He wants to remain in charge. Tradition is the same. If you're appealing to tradition, you're going to be choosing which tradition carries more authority than another tradition, which one to be accepted, which one to be rejected. But so keep pushing. Realize when he says something like that, science or tradition or the majority or whatever, know that he's hiding at this moment behind these things to get him to admit what his final authority is. So when the unbeliever is called on to explain his claims, the things that he makes, the statements he makes, this threatens him. Because his policy is to adopt ideas and formulate conclusions that are really very paper thin. Puts up this veneer, and when he's in his own circles and when he's walking around those whom are like-minded with him, they don't get challenged. Those veneers are unchallenged, and he has this false sense of security. But when you start to push into that area to get him to realize how flimsy his defenses are, and he had banked everything on that. In Zimbabwe, you have brick houses. So they're very secure in the sense you could break through one of these walls pretty easily with an axe or something. But in Zimbabwe you can't, because the whole thing, it's brick. And then for the security you would have thick burglar bars covering up the doorways and windows. And if you had a bit more money you could also put alarm systems, not the infrared systems, but just alarm systems on all the windows and doors. So that any time a glass is broken or a window is opened or a door is opened, security there is a huge money-making business, so you can have armed security response to come, because the police don't respond. Armed security private firms to respond to this break-in at your house. And I had a friend who had a house like this, and he was very secure. You know, he had a lot of nice things in his house, and he had set this thing up, had all these bases covered. The roofs in Zimbabwe are tiles, and these tiles, they just kind of link into each other. There's no nails or anything, they just kind of all hook and link in each other. So you get on the roof, and you just slide one tile up, which is not hard, and you can just dismantle that whole roof, and you hop in, and then the ceiling is not like this, it's just kind of like compressed paper. That's kind of the texture of the stuff. It's, you know, kind of a board they've made out of paper. It's light and stuff. Come through the roof, help yourself, put it up through the roof again, and you're gone. So, in many respects, the unbeliever's position, his worldview, when he's in his circles many times, and the things he adopts, it's that false sense of security. And all we're doing is showing him that there's a huge weakness here that is kind of off your radar screen, and you're unaware of it, and you're trying to make him aware of it by showing him that as fancy as his alarm systems are, he is very vulnerable. He's overlooking this glaring weakness, and that is that his many claims lack authority. He's making statements that do not have authority behind them. There's no real support for the things he holds to. So all you're doing is showing him the vulnerability of his roof. And how does this look? Well, the unbeliever might be attacking some aspect of Christian morality, which is often, particularly something that doesn't quite agree with them. He could be saying that marriage being defined as to be between one man and one woman is just outdated. It's oppressive. It's an oppressive encroachment upon man's freedoms and liberty. It's an oppressive encroachment upon this new liberated age that we live in. It stifles freedom and it stifles expression, and he could fill it out in many different ways. That's his view, and the people believe that. The president believes that, and thus he is fighting to free the nation from such oppressive restraints and constraints. So your response to that would be, well, how do you know that it is oppressive rather than the foundation of freedom? I'd like to know. I'm really interested. How do you know? So don't react to it. Just say, how do you know that this is oppressive and not actually the foundation of freedom? Can he explain? Because the more he has to try and explain, the flimsier he realizes his foundation is. He realizes, I really don't have an explanation. I've just assumed this. I've just taken it from my culture, the days I live in, the times I live in, and because I've seen many people espousing it, I've adopted it. So you're asking him just to explain that, how he can be sure about that. You see, you're asking him to tell you what his authority is, and you keep asking that question until he admits what his final authority is. This is the source of his knowledge. You want him to come to the point where he admits, this is the source of my knowledge. This is the source of my ethics, which is going to be himself, finally. So it's because of this authority that the unbeliever convinces himself that he can be sure that the things he claims to be true really are true. If he's confident in that, I know this is my authority, but he hasn't identified it usually, what that actually is. And you're helping him to see that. Because when you help him to see that, I believe it starts to unravel in his mind as you show him the inconsistencies and the impossibility of his position. So now that he has admitted what his final authority is, you can evaluate whether it's able to serve in this capacity. And the bottom line is it can't. He cannot be his own final authority. The only way he can make it appear to work is by being inconsistent and arbitrary. And so you must be on the lookout for that. Now you're trying to get him. He's admitted it. I'm the final authority. And now you get him to unpack by continuing to ask him the questions. And you're going to watch now for his inconsistency and arbitrariness. He's going to be chopping and changing as to what he claims to be true, to how life actually functions and how he lives his life. And you point that out to him. Well, if everyone can be inconsistent and arbitrary, then what does life look like? If you can just chop and change as you want, can everybody do that? And how does life function in that sense? You see, there's a common illustration for both of these things, this inconsistency and arbitrariness, which is where people go when they are not standing on biblical ethics, when they're not standing upon biblical authority, where they can say, this is what I do because God's word proclaims it and establishes it, then they become inconsistent and arbitrary. And the best illustration of that is, you know the illustration, but I'll repeat it. When you're speaking to the guy about some moral issue, and his response is, there are no moral absolutes. There are no moral absolutes. Now, he's being incredibly inconsistent there, because he denies the possibility of absolute absolutes with this absolute statement. So you need to be aware he's being inconsistent. And so you press him on this inconsistency, and then what's going to come out is arbitrariness. Well, that's the only one. That's the only absolute, is that there are no absolutes. And I can make that just by my decree. So now he's being arbitrary. He can just decree something and that's it. It establishes it. That's the foundation and basis. So be aware of that. And at that point, you could take it in many different directions as to how you would dismantle things. But keep him explaining. That's what you want. Keep him explaining how he knows. Or the unbeliever might say that he has met a number of Christians who are hypocrites. I don't know if you've ever met somebody who said that. I have met a number of Christians. In fact, my neighbor is a Christian and he's a hypocrite. And therefore, Christianity is just a religion for hypocrites. Just the whole thing is hypocritical. How do you respond to that? You can evaluate him as well and see if he's consistent. Are you being consistent? For example, do you treat every people group, every profession, every profession, do you treat that in the same way? For example, if you met three Irishmen that lied to you, does that prove all Irishmen are liars? If you came across three doctors who are quacks, quack being a medical doctor who professes to be qualified and is practicing medicine when he's not trained. So because if you meet a couple of quacks, does that mean every medical doctor is a quack? You see, I want you to be consistent. Is that how you approach life? Is that how you formulate your categories? So you want him to be consistent, and you're going to point out to him his inconsistencies. And then, you know, you can, it's like the woman driver thing, isn't it? You see a lady do something stupid on the road, and the guy says, woman drivers. And the man does something stupid, and he says, that man is an idiot. You put people in categories very quickly. Well, there's another way you approach that. You can go down that line, or you could ask him how he knows what hypocrisy is. How do you define hypocrisy? How can you explain what hypocrisy looks like? And why is it bad? Why is it bad? How do you know that hypocrisy is not actually the higher virtue that we should be aiming at? Maybe it is the standard that we should all be aiming at. Why is hypocrisy bad in your system? How can we know? So you're asking these questions. You see, the same question you keep repeating, you can word it in different ways, but he's the one now who's got to explain, and he's just assuming that hypocrisy is bad. Why is he assuming that? What's he doing when he assumes hypocrisy is bad? He's stealing. And where's he stealing from? The Christian worldview. He's jumping across, taking what Christianity says, and then stepping back in his worldview, and he feels he's got the right and the liberty to use that without explaining it, without accounting for it, without defining it, because everybody knows what hypocrisy is, and therefore hypocrisy is bad. But he's stealing at that point. So now you're going to say, wait a bit, I want you to explain hypocrisy in your worldview and why it is wrong in your worldview that hypocrisy is bad. What is the standard that shows that to you? See, because the unbeliever will arbitrarily choose the morals that he wants from the Christian worldview, thinking that he can do that without having to explain his actions. But you want to know how his worldview accounts for morality, whether good or evil. How does it account for it? Explain it to me. So remember, you need to keep the discussion on the worldview level. Keep the whole picture in view. Everything he claims to believe and not believe, this all has to be viewed in the context of real life and how this person actually lives in the world. You want to keep that all consistent. What he's professing, how he lives, how you experience life. And you keep that all together, that whole worldview flowing. You need to keep all these aspects together and make sure they are supporting each other. They won't be. And so what you're looking for the whole time is these inconsistencies and arbitrariness, where he's just, by his own word, rules something, good or bad, with no authority, no basis, no ability to defend it. You need to be ready to respond why the scriptures are the authority. And remember, the way you're going to do that, so that if he turns the tables on you, you're not seen as doing something arbitrary, is by presenting it in the worldview again, isn't it? The whole worldview, and you just demonstrate the consistency why Christianity is the only thing that can give explanation and purpose and understanding to all of life. And I'll kind of touch on that towards the end. But you keep the whole worldviews. Remember, it's worldviews that are clashing with each other here, and you keep the worldviews together. When you're doing an internal critique, what you're actually doing, you are coming across and saying, okay, Grant, I'm giving you the floor. You can speak. You can tell us, and I'm standing on your worldview, and I'm just trying to evaluate within your worldview if it's consistent. And when we've done that with your worldview, then we can come across to my worldview, and you can stand in my worldview and look, and I'll explain how it addresses life and how it's consistent or inconsistent. You can, at that point, ask your questions and come at my worldview and see if it can stand up to scrutiny. So, for example, if this person says that Christian morals are just plain stupid, you need to ask him how he knows this. Then start defending morals right then. Ask him how to explain how he knows that. You know, rather than saying, oh, no, but that's the only... Just explain to me. Explain how you know that they are stupid. When people are not buying to Christ and his truth, they are very inconsistent. If you've ever stood in a pro-life parade holding a picture of aborted babies, you'll see strange reactions from those who promote the abortion agenda. Some become extremely angry because you are publicly displaying such horrible pictures of ripped apart babies. They become incensed. They are pro-abortion and incensed at those pictures. And they claim that you're being insensitive by displaying such pictures in public. Would they be offended, so offended, if you were holding up a picture of your removed appendix? Would they? No. I assure you they would not be offended by a picture of an appendix that's been removed from somebody's body. And yet they claim that what's in a mother's womb is only fetal tissue. It's not a human, it's not a person, it's fetal tissue. And yet they react to the pictures of this fetal tissue when it is shown in its dismembered form. And they wouldn't react if you put up the placenta, the afterbirth, the picture of the placenta. They wouldn't react to that. I mean, they wouldn't be horrified by it. But they react to these pictures of them. It's interesting. There's an inconsistency. And I mean, it's just an illustration, but you can constantly be looking for the inconsistencies in the unbeliever's worldview because they're there. He cannot function without inconsistency. And you just need to be alert to identifying that. The Christian's authority in Scripture, that's what it is. This is what we rely upon. That's our foundation. That's the basis of our authority. That is what shows us what is true and how to defend the truth. That is where we start and that is where we end. And so the Scriptures tell us that the unbeliever, he knows the truth, but is constantly trying to suppress that truth in unrighteousness. So now, while the believer can use arguments that prove the existence of God, there's nothing wrong with using an argument to prove God's existence in that sense. As long as we base that argument on the foundation that Scripture shows us of who the unbeliever is, which means the unbeliever is not ignorant about God. The unbeliever is not there saying, well, I'm not sure if God exists. No, we don't grant him that ground. We know that God does exist, and so we don't grant the unbeliever legitimacy to those claims that he makes. So when we are presenting the proof of God's existence, we must not at any stage grant legitimacy to the unbeliever's claims that he doesn't know if God exists. We must never allow the unbeliever to think that his mind is able, independently of God, to arrive at true knowledge. Man's mind is a defective tool and is incapable of arriving at truth on its own. Thus, we mustn't allow the unbeliever to use his mind as the final authority for determining possibilities and for defining truth. Well, my mind's going to determine the possibility of God's existence. Sorry, your mind is incapable of doing that. So we don't even start down that discussion. We don't even start down that route. Rather, we must always be showing the unbeliever that when he relies upon his own resources, he can't account for anything. And we do that by asking him to explain how he knows what he claims to know and how he can be sure about those claims. We want to know what authority he's resting upon. And the more he has to answer this simple question, the more his inconsistency and arbitrariness will be revealed. And we need to have the confidence and the boldness to do that, rather than being threatened by sophistication or threatened by his aggressive approach to denouncing and denying Christianity. And as young folk, you need to realize that. Do not be intimidated by that. Know these inescapable. He does not have an argument that can overturn Christianity. And you want to get him to speak, and that's the way you get him to speak, by asking those questions. As I've said, the final authority is usually himself, and you can point that out to him if he doesn't recognize it. And people might be very reluctant to come to admitting it, but if they admit it, you get them to admit it, you have a tremendous advantage in unraveling everything and helping them to see the flimsiness of their position. Even if the person appeals to science as authority for something, who said the experiments have been done and that proves it. Now, strict science, when you're just dealing with experimentation, I believe there is a unified result that comes out. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about where science now delves into the realm of proving origins and establishing those kinds of things. And when science steps into that, it's dealing outside its sphere. And so when he appeals to science to establish those things, science does not speak with a unified voice when it comes to that subject. For example, carbon dating, dating fossils and bones. There's no unified voice that science speaks with as far as these experiments always produce this, because it's delving in something that is very speculative. When the unbeliever admits that he is his own highest authority, you can respond in many different ways. I mean, you can even say, well, how does he know that he's able to function in this way? Well, I just do. Because I do function like that, therefore I have legitimacy to do it. I mean, there's other directions you could take that if you wanted. So we just must not be intimidated by those who deny Christianity, because they have no workable alternative. They really do not have anything in order to explain and account for life. And it's not difficult to reveal this fact. So there's basically four things that I've pulled together here that allow us, if we can just follow these simple things, we will not be shaken by any assault against Christ's truth. No matter how sophisticated it might be, no matter how intellectual the man might be, if you can just remember these things, when you're debating an unbeliever, you'll be more than able to dismantle his arguments. Firstly, you need to ask him, what's the source of the authority that backs up his claims? You're trying to find out his final authority. And that might take a while, but that's the objective. I want to find out what's this guy's authority. Secondly, you need to keep the discussion on the worldview level. That is, make sure that his claims about life match up to with life as you see it in this world, and also match up with how he lives his life. If he's calling fetal tissue and then he's appalled by abortion pictures, his worldview and his concept of that issue are disconnected. So you want to keep him faithful and consistent. Because basically what you're doing an internal critique of his worldview. When he's told you what he believes, you're seeing if he's actually living according to those principles and seeing if he's consistent with that. Thirdly, you need to be on the alert for him being inconsistent and arbitrary and point that out to him. Now, this doesn't connect. I'm not evaluating your worldview by mine now. I'm just, by your own professed, there's inconsistency here. Because you support abortion and you said these pictures are terrible. I didn't put any words in your mouth. I'm just evaluating your relationship to life at this point and seeing the consistency or inconsistency. You're being arbitrary or you're being inconsistent. And fourthly, you must not grant legitimacy at any stage to the way the unbeliever uses his mind. That is, people cannot arrive at true knowledge independently of God. And so when the unbeliever uses his mind autonomously, you must not accept his conclusions as valid. You have no authority for what you said. So they're all connected and interrelated, but those four points will help you to just stay on track when you're talking to somebody and you're thinking, where am I going? What am I trying to accomplish? How can I get there? And then you're not threatened. You're not kind of scratching around in the dust like a chicken trying to find something. You know where you're going, and you know that this person doesn't have the answers. He does not have a consistent worldview that he can present. And all you're trying to do is help him see that that is the case. So my hope is that by knowing and doing these things, you'll be confident and unthreatened by any assault brought against Christianity. And when your discussion is shaped by these principles, you'll be providing the clearest proof for the Christian God. And that is that without him, you can't prove anything. That's what you're doing. Because without authority, you can prove nothing. And so you're actually giving the clearest demonstration of Christianity when you're dismantling his arguments according to the scriptures. You can't make sense out of life. You can't account for life as you know it and as we live in this world. You cannot account for that without Christianity, without the revelation that God has given us. And what you've done, you're showing him that, and you've shown him the impossibility of the contrary. Dr. Bonson, I don't know if that was Van Til's term, I can't remember, but it's his idea. But you're demonstrating to the unbeliever the impossibility of the contrary, that unless Christianity is true, nothing else is possible, nothing else is provable. So you defend this. However, as we close, remember that when you're defending, we are never to be arrogant or rude in our discussion. What's most effective is for the person you debate to afterwards have his attention focused upon the fact that his worldview was shown to be bankrupt, rather than him being caught up with how rude and arrogant you were, and using your rudeness and your arrogance to sidestep the real issue. Man, that was a guy who was full of himself, wasn't it? just by the way you're talking, by the way you kind of tone and the features on your face, you know, your expressions on your face, you can communicate that arrogance and lack of respecting the person, lack of true care and love for that person. So you can keep it calm. And if you're not threatened, that's a big contribution towards your calmness. You're not threatened. You know what your position is, you know what the authority is, and you just stand there and you get him to explain his worldview. You can explain your worldview. You can account for sin, you can account for judgment, you can account for why people do what they do, for the good they do, for the bad they do. You can account for hypocrites. You're not threatened by hypocrites in the church. You can explain why a hypocrite is a hypocrite and why God's word condemns that and why we should not be hypocrites. But you know why we shouldn't be hypocrites. He doesn't know why people shouldn't be hypocrites. And so there's no need for you to be threatened. As you stand on your position, because you're confident about your position, you can ask with gentleness and graciousness in the way you discuss with him. If he's going to hate the truth, let him hate the truth for the sake of the truth, not hate the truth because of your pride and arrogance and self-centeredness or whatever else flowed from you, your immaturity or lack of self-control. So treating others with dignity and respect is what the Christian worldview demands, and we are meant to defend the truth in a way that is consistent with that worldview. So we're not only wanting to communicate this truth, we want to communicate it how the truth tells us we should communicate it. Hopefully that gives you a few weapons that you can keep close to you and at least have a direction of how you're going to approach or take a discussion when somebody comes at you and discusses something in that way or opposes and undermines Christianity. But as you think through different issues, just remember these 4 points. My objective is that you can go away with something and be confident and realize I truly can hold my ground in any debate as far as dealing with these issues. You'll stand. If he's going to attack Christianity and try and undermine your faith, you'll stand if you remember these principles. And so particularly for you young guys, as you grow up, you'll come into more and more encounters with people who will share these ideas and have opposing views to what you used to. You need to know how to stand. Any other comments, illustrations? Okay.